I mean, straight used to be the norm, I guess, even though it's never been the norm, because those who did have stories and those who were on the spectrum or gay, their voices were just silenced. So we've been kind of programmed to believe that way back when this was the norm. And we had like a bunch of straight people had a whole lot of audacity to judge and to critique others who were indulging in the same activities as them, and they were either deeming it as unnatural or savage or disgusting or deplorable and not of God and all of this insane stuff, to be frank. But anyways, I take a sip of wine and I digress. This is Single and Probably Asexual with Kendra K. At the top of this podcast, I would like to mention there are several trigger warnings in this episode. I discuss rape, harm and violence to marginalized people, the LGBTQIA plus community. I talk about sexual assault, death, killings, and just a whole lot of oppression to those who are oppressed. So I normally put this in the description, which I still will, but I know oftentimes most people don't read that. So I just wanted to kind of give you a little heads up at the beginning of this episode. And I would also like to mention that I am recording this episode in my beautiful new little hometown of Bellingham, Washington. New hometown, but old hometown. I used to live here decades ago when I, well, maybe not decades ago. Yeah, no, decades ago. Third grade, I was probably like 10. Anyways, I am recording here in Bellingham, and I wanted to just acknowledge that the land that I am recording on is from the Lummi Nation and the Nooksack Tribe. So I just wanted to just say a big thanks to those who came before us and to those that occupied this land and that still occupy this land. A big appreciation and thank you for Bellingham and this cozy little place that I like to call home. So, thank you all so much, and I'm very excited for everyone to listen to this episode. Alrighty, here we go. Welcome, welcome, welcome back. Today, I am joined by a glass of red wine. And yes, I put ice in my red wine. Call me Diane Keaton. But I have a glass of red wine today because our topic is a lot. And you know, sometimes a little glass of wine is necessary. So today, I'm going to be talking about compulsory sexuality, and there are probably going to be a few parts to this, definitely at least two. So you'll be able to hear part two in like a month because I post an episode just of me and then an episode with an interview. So my episode in 2 more weeks is going to be an interview, and then 2 weeks after that, so kind of like a month, you will get part two of this, which I am very excited about. It's a topic, you know? And that is why I am kind of breaking it down into multiple parts. And of course, this entire episode and, you know, the parts to come after this episode are all heavily inspired by this book that I have been reading called Refusing Compulsory Sexuality: A Black Asexual Lens on Our Sex-Obsessed Culture. And the author is Sharonda J. Brown. The foreword is by Hess Love, and the afterword is by Grace B. Freedom. And man, it is, yeah, I have been learning a lot. Very necessary learning. It has been incredibly, like, profound on my end, to be completely honest. Sharonda J. Brown is an exceptional author. They are so... This book is just so outstanding. Like, there is an index in the back, and everything that they mention within the chapters that have, you know, like the little asterisks or numbers on them are all copied for in the back, and you can read on all of these little things that they have squeezed into an already very resourceful and educational book. So I'll dedicate this podcast and the parts that come after this podcast to Sharonda J. Brown, because a lot of what I have learned from them in their book is what I will be speaking about with you guys today. Yeah, so I'm very excited. I told you guys I was going to do some research on this, and I'm excited to say that I have a couple other books on asexuality that I'm very excited and eager to get into. But I'm also just sidebar. I'm in this space as a white, incredibly privileged woman. I've been finding myself wanting to learn and get my education from people of color, especially women of color. You know, their voices have been silenced for years and years and years. And I feel like, to be completely frank, being a white person, I'm tired of learning from white people because it's from the white lens, and the white lens is incredibly disruptive and harmful and a lot. So I'm excited to further continue my education just in general with things that interest me in life and past events that I would like to, you know, learn that maybe I should have learned in high school or middle school. From the perspective and from the writings of people of color and indigenous people. So very, very, very looking forward. Very, very, very looking forward. I'm very much looking forward to reading from a perspective that isn't a white perspective, because our entire country, unfortunately, has been built and it's been built off of white people. It's been built for white people. It is to benefit those who are white. It is to benefit those who are rich. It is to benefit those white males. Essentially I'm in a place where I want to learn elsewhere, so to speak, because what I have been taught and what I have ingested in my entire life has been solely from the bias of a white lens due to this country and due to my family, obviously, you know, coming from a white family. So let's just get into it. Now, before I immediately get into compulsory sexuality, we're going to just touch a little bit on some asexuality stuff. Everything that I speak about with compulsory sexuality obviously directly affects people who are asexual, because, I mean, compulsory sexuality is that, you know, the thought that people think that everyone thinks the same about sex, which asexuals definitely do not. One thing that I did take note here in this book by Sharonda J. Brown is that they said asexuality is basically self-contained sexuality. A lot of people who identify as asexual are on the ace spectrum. They don't have that urge to, you know, be compulsory with their sexuality and act on those sexual instincts, because there is either a lack of, or there is just not a general, you know, desire to do. So I thought Sharonda saying that asexuality is basically self-contained sexuality is really beautiful, because as everyone knows, people can have their own sexual intimacy and experiences solo. It doesn't have to be in a partnership situation. It's And it's just whatever you want to make it. And I think that's really beautiful because, obviously having a sense of self is very important, but to also be able to explore in your own way, on your own time, with your own self and body is really beautiful. There is this really beautiful excerpt, is that the right word? This, like, a quote in this book from bell hooks. And they say, all of our lives we have experienced ourselves as queer, as not belonging, as the essence of queer. Queer not being about who you're having sex with. That can be a dimension of it, of course, but queer as in being about the self that is at odds with everything around it and has to invent and create and find a place to speak and thrive and live. And again, I just thought that was a really beautiful quote that I wanted to share with you guys because, with all, the adversities with being queer or gay or asexual or trans, we, as queer people, have really had to define, and people who have come before me have had to define what queer love is and also what queer sex is, and to have it not also be some weird fetishized thing from the cis heteronormative lens or the straight lens. I mean, sex is sex, and at some point, straight people just deemed queer sex and gay sex and, trans sex and any sort of intimacy dealing with any person, however they identify, as long as they were not a cisgendered man and a cisgendered woman, as wrong. It was not what our, I guess, world was used to, or back in the day, when people who were on the spectrum thought they needed to be silenced in order to not literally be killed or have their families be hurt. I mean, straight used to be the norm, I guess, even though it's never been the norm, because those who did have stories and those who were on the spectrum or gay, their voices were just silenced. So we've been kind of programmed to believe that way back when this was the norm. And we had, like, a bunch of straight people had a whole lot of audacity to judge and to critique others who were indulging in the same activities as them. And they were either deeming it as unnatural or savage or disgusting or deplorable and not of God and all of this insane stuff, to be frank. But anyways, I take a sip of wine and I digress. Moving on. So, you may be wondering, some of you, what is compulsory sexuality? So the definition that Sharonda gives in their book is, compulsory sexuality is the idea that sex is universally desired as a feature of human nature, and that we are essentially obligated to participate in sex at some point in life, and that there is something fundamentally wrong with anyone who does not want to, whether it is perceived as a deficit of morality, psychology, or physiology. I don't even know if I said that right, but I'm leaving it in because nobody's perfect. Some more words from Sharonda here. So, with the definition being read, compulsory sexuality directly correlates to rape culture, demoralizing people on the ace spectrum. It upholds heterosexual and heteropatriarchal notions. White supremacy is also highly linked in here as well. Which put most people in jeopardy to violence and discrimination. And those, sorry, I can't even read my own handwriting. Those individuals susceptible to this violence and discrimination are women, children, people of color, queer folk, trans folks, and sex adverse people. And I say white supremacy is highly linked in what compulsory sexuality is because, I mean, essentially, the white man created compulsory sexuality forever ago. Someone said, all men and women must have sex. This is also something that everybody desires. This is also something that is due to those who are of a certain ethnic group, such as white people. I guess it's a different ethnicity, but not ethnic, if you know what I'm saying. Because, I mean, it's difficult to talk. It's not difficult to talk about, but it's just, there's just a lot, like, there's just a lot I want to say, but a lot that I'm trying to, you know, just kind of give you facts head on and not maybe share my opinions as much, maybe. I don't know. I guess I should. This is my podcast. But, you know, essentially, white men have controlled our entire world. And we are so controlled by the patriarchy and the economy and all of these things that were initially set up by white men. Another amazing piece from this book that Sharonda says is, when our society largely accepts sex as a mandatory practice and also remains deeply invested in cis heteronormativity and cis heteropatriarchy, white supremacy, capitalism, healthism, ableism, fatphobia, anti-blackness, rape culture, and more, it is imperative to examine how compulsory sexuality impacts the most marginalized. And it does, because when this, you know, idea was created, you know, it was a long time ago. And back then, you know, people of color still don't have nearly as many rights as, you know, the cis born white person, but, you know, it directly affects a lot of people going with this grain or this notion of sex and what people should be doing with their bodies and with other people at their most intimate self. Like, it's all kind of been set up, so to speak, for us. And of course, those among many, those who are women and children are incredibly they're at such a high risk for violence and discrimination, because in this culture of compulsory sexuality created by white men and that uphold, you know, cis heteronormativity and the patriarchy, of course, that it affects women. And, you know, you hear a lot of stories about people being, you know, coming from abusive households. And a lot of the time, not a lot of the time, I feel like even today, most men, and especially white men, believe that sex should be given to them. It's hard to think about like serial killers, which there's part of me loves true crime and all of that stuff, but it's kind of fucked up because most serial killers are white and most serial killers kill women, and before they kill them or after they kill them, they tend to rape them as well or sexually assault them, because again, especially the white male believes that this is entitled to them. And they believe that because our entire country and everything has allowed them to believe that. And not only allow them to believe that, but to almost encourage them and make them feel like it is pure obligation to them, which is terrible and it's disgusting. And again, in relating it to serial killers, it's why there is so much violence against women, because these people who are mass murderers, some may have weird fetishes about killing and blood and stuff like that, but a lot of the times these men want to assault women, and after they assault them, they, you know, kill them. And it's incredibly it's disheartening AF, honestly. And I may touch about this more in part two, about how our Black community has been so incredibly disproportioned, obviously in this country and in the past and in our lifetime. I mean, when we think about Southern plantation owners who were white, back when slavery was very much active in this country, the violence against women and children, especially those who are of color, it was almost like it was at an all-time high. Men were forced to be slaves and women were forced to be slaves, Black men and Black women. Most of the Black men would be out in the fields or doing, housework and stuff, and the women would be inside. And a lot of those women would be raped. And I'm not saying that there is a lesser or non-lesser for people who were, for Black humans who were enslaved, but Black women have quite literally been treated as nothing for a long time. And I'm going to say the word disheartening probably like 1,000 times. It's not even disheartening. It's disturbing and it's like unbearable. Obviously, I mean, not obviously, like for me, I don't understand that lived viewpoint, but thinking about it, it's horrible is what it is. And to think that Black women who were also enslaved were being taken advantage of with their bodies because white men were owed sex. Moving on, there's also a really great little numbers thing here that Sharonda says in the book. In the 2015 asexual community census, 43.5% of the ACEs surveyed reported past sexual violence, including rape, assault, and coercion. And 50.6% of those respondents had experienced sexual violence with their romantic partners. In 2018, so a few years later, the asexual census saw the number increase to 79.5%. So it went from 43.5%, and in 3 years, that increased to 79.5%. And to continue, percent of ACEs surveyed having experienced sexual violence. In each report, racially marginalized asexuals, of course, were more likely to have experienced sexual violence. Another thing that I really took away from Sharonda's book so far, is that there's a large amount of people today, and especially back in the day, who thought that asexuality was just, it was not normal. It was unheard of. It was false, all this bullshit, to be frank. And they also said in this book, I forgot where in this book it was, but people who didn't understand asexuals, especially if they were partnered with an asexual, or dating asexual or having sex with an asexual, a lot of this abuse that asexuals have experienced, the sexual abuse either from partners or people that they had a date with or whatever, the person who was attacking and, assaulting asexuals, they had this insane, creepy notion that they can just fix asexuals. Like, to say, like, oh, you just need to be like effed really well or something like that. And there has been an insane amount of abuse towards asexuals for that very reason. And it's disgusting and it's horrible because we can't just accept who we are and who other people are, even if we don't understand that. and people who think that they're coming in to fix these sort of people when they are actually just further damaging them. It's terrible. Another big thing that I have taken away from this book is because we have been, this country is based off of white people stealing this land, coming in and asserting new rules and asserting how people are going to live, you know, all these things, X, Y, and Z. It has also put this insane, like, plague on people who are queer. And another thing that an amazing little excerpt from, I think I'm saying that right. I don't know. Who knows? Someone correct me. Another excerpt from this book that Sharonda says is, the hyper-focus on queer sex and sex roles is a direct result of over-sexualization of queerness as a means to construct it as nothing more than sexual deviance and to also reassert heteronormative gender roles within queer relations. Example, the myth that masks cannot be bottoms and femmes cannot be tops, due to the misogynistic idea that masculine sex partners must always penetrate feminine sex partners, because both penetration and masculinity are conflated with dominance and control, while femininity and being penetrated are associated with being passive and submissive under someone else's rule. This, too, is a symptom of compulsory heterosexuality, and it creates limitations and harms for all queer folks. Now, that is something I had never thought of before. And when I read that, immediately highlighted it, of course. And it's so true, though. Because, again, even those who are queer under, you know, the umbrella of the LGBTQI labels, a lot of us have still unfortunately been raised in this time or era of patriarchal bullshit. You know, the man has got to be the man. A woman has got to be a woman. And of course, I'm well confirmed in this idea that you have probably heard multiple times when you are speaking to a couple that are gay or lesbians, you know, who's the man and who's the woman? Who's the man and who's the woman? Time and time and time again. And I have probably also been a culprit of saying that to a couple when I was younger, dumber, not as educated, not just a ignorant kid, basically. But to me, it's obviously ignorance today. But back then, it was almost like a common question. And my, like, mind was blown open reading that, because I didn't realize, I mean, I realize how heavy the patriarchy is in our lives, in our world. It controls how we act, how we dress, what we eat, who we socialize with, where we vacate, like all of these things. And it was, yeah, that was just, whew, where's my wine? And to, like, slightly touch on this, lesbians are incredibly, incredibly hypersexualized, and mostly by men. And I was working at a hotel, when I was like 19. So this was a long time ago. And I remember so little backstory, the hotel that I worked at had a lot of people who were mostly traveling to that state where I was working and working at the hotel to work on like construction jobs. It was an extended stay hotel, so I had, to be perfectly frank, a lot of white older men who were staying there. And I remember one day when I was cleaning the breakfast bar that there was a group of white men at the breakfast bar having a casual conversation about how two men being together is absolutely not okay. While on the other hand, two women being together, well, that was fine. That's fine for them. Totally fine for them. And that was fine for them. Why? Because as the heteronormative man, they believe that lesbians were a group of lovers who they can just, like, it was accepted to them in a weird way that was purely sexual. They found it arousing. They found it disgusting that a man and a man could be together. But the prospect of a woman and a woman being together was all right with them. And I know that that didn't come down to rights, emotional rights, or anything like that, or having the truth and the freedom and the space to love who you want to love. It was purely a weird, fetishized sexual desire by them. Moving on. So, asexuality was never like a big topic of discussion on the sexuality spectrum, being like the straight sexuality spectrum and the gay, LGBTQI, oh my gosh, I'm like fumbling over my words, my letters here. But asexuality was never discussed on any spectrum because those who were straight and those who were even gay or identified under the umbrella of LGBTQ didn't fathom sexuality to be real or true at all. Because when you know, the movement started happening for people who were queer and people who were gay, it was to fight their right to be with the person that they love and to also be intimate with the person that they love. And in a world where sex is so, it's on the forefront daily, you know, their sex sells everywhere, everything. It's how this country was honestly built off of. It's how we profit. It's how the economy stays going strong, is if people continue to have sex and reproduce and all these other things. But to think, to even fathom that people didn't want to have sex, it made people who were asexual targets from straight people and from even gay people. I mean, asexuality, there are so many adverse thoughts and feelings about asexuality from others. And, you know, of course, when there's adversity and when adversity happens to someone or a group of people, it is often met with harm and rejection. When something feels unnatural to somebody else and they can't even possibly imagine not having these desires or doing this or, you know, and it even goes as far as like people who don't want to have kids or who do want to have kids, just because you feel a certain way doesn't give you the right to harm or discriminate or criticize those who feel opposite, who feel maybe totally opposite to you. Because as speaking from the asexual lens myself, I feel normal. Like, I feel fine. I don't feel like I am this unnatural, weird being that doesn't feel the same way that, quote unquote, everybody should feel. And it literally just comes back to just basic love and kindness and acceptance for others. And you know, that even goes politically. I don't agree with a lot of Republicans, and I don't like a lot of Republicans, and people who voted for Trump, I kind of turned my head away because I don't, you know, These are my own thoughts and opinions. But it goes as far as that. If we can just accept people, no matter what our differences are, if we have different opinions, if we have different beliefs, I mean, that's truly what will lead to like a revolution of change in this world, which we so desperately need because unfortunately we are so politically at odds in this country. And the more that we are politically at odds, the more that we are going to critique and criticize those who are different from us in other ways. And again, it leads to harm, it leads to violence, it leads to sexual assault, it leads to rape, it leads to people feeling that they should have control or dominance over a group of people. And again, this is mostly coming from the male lens because men have created this. They've created this country, this created this world. They created the laws back in the day that women couldn't vote and there were less rights to those who were people of color and women and children. I mean, we all know this, but I'll speak for myself. I didn't realize how much of the patriarchy runs through everything, including who or when we are having sex. It's fucking baffling. And I can also relate this to, you know, bodies. You know, me being a boudoir photographer, I want to encourage self-love for everybody, men, women, people who are non-binary, because all the things that we have been force-fed our entire lives, we have also been force-fed that who we are in our skin and in our bodies is not enough. Men have been shown that, women have been shown that, and especially people who consider themselves non-binary have definitely been shown that, you know? As a woman, we need to be, and it's changing now, which is insane because like, for once, you know, like a long time ago, it was like, you've got to be thin, you've got to be skinny, you've got to look this way, you've got to have, you know, nice perky tits and all this stuff. And now it's changing with social media. I mean, whatever the Kardashians' bodies look like one day is how the country we show up. We show up with the curves and stuff. People get plastic surgery. People alter their bodies to conform to the norm. And so when I say it's similar to bodies, there's such animosity, I feel, a lot of times between those who are thin and those who are fat. Because those who are thin cannot fathom being fat. They cannot imagine being fat. So therefore, they fat shame. And they've been taught to fat shame their entire lives, which is the sad part. And there are even people out there who maybe they're body positive, but their fat shaming still kind of creeps up because it was inherently taught to a lot of people. Me coming from a family of a lot of able bodies, of white family, not a lot of, I thank God, like not a lot of health concerns like, you know, cancer or anything like that that can run genetically, but coming from a very abled white family where most of the people in my family are thin or, you know, slimmer than others, myself, it's met with adversity. It's met with rejection. And it's the same for fat people. Fat people who are fat and who that's just who they are, they feel comfortable in their bodies, they're fat and they love it. And they probably can't even fathom being so skinny, depriving themselves of food and comfort and overworking their bodies just to look a certain way or to fit in with what the patriarchy wants you to do, what social media wants you to do, what the Kardashians subliminally want you to do, what your family wants you to do. And when we keep rejecting people. We reject asexuals for not being sexual. We reject gay people for going against the norm, even though the norm was never the norm. People were just silenced and or killed. And going against other people for their physical appearance. We are stuck in this world full of people who just fucking judge. And the sad thing is we're almost taught to judge. We are taught to critique the person who is fat. We are taught to critique the person who's not having sex because what? Their body chemistry doesn't allow them to? Bullshit. We're taught to scrutinize people of the same sex to be together. It's this never-ending cycle of judgment and abuse. But this is the blueprint that we were given. This is the blueprint that we were all given. And this blueprint created by the white man was also given to those people, like to people of color. This isn't a blueprint most of us have wanted, but this is a blueprint that we have lived and grown as a society off of for countless years. And again, I'm going to say it 1,000 times. When we do this, when we criticize others just for being, just for who they are, the color of their skin, how they feel naturally in their body, who they're desired to be with in partnerships, it just continues to lead us directly to discrimination and violence to those who are marginalized, simply for just literally being themselves. All right, briefly off the topic of the white man and how we as a country are suffering greatly for what the white man has proposed to us. What am I trying to say? Oh my God. Anyway, I'm just moving on. So, a couple little more fun things. I believe most of my listeners are of the generation of millennial. So this is going to be really, really, really interesting for a lot of people, but also not so interesting because a lot of this, as you know, millennials, we have already known this. Oh, and also I want to say another little insert, what have you not, from the book by Sharonda about the queer communities and how we are, you know, oppressed and all that stuff. Sharonda says, all queer communities are facing the same enemy, white supremacist, cis heteropatriarchy, and sexual, relational, and gender normativity. Exclusionary politics keep us focused on fighting each other for space, connection, and resources rather than using our collective power to combat the belief systems that oppress us all. And of course, there are a lot of us out there who are trying to combat those belief sources, but when you have a large majority of the world, and especially people in the United States who have thought a certain way, a very colonial way, it's hard to make that change because there is a large portion of people out there who do not want to see us make that change. And sadly, those who are in charge on the side of the patriarchy, white supremacy, and all of that, just like what I said, are white. And big companies, most of the CEOs in this country are white men. And what we are fed through commercials, department stores, all of this stuff, the school education system, it has been based off of white men. So, of course, we have been oppressed since the dawn of time, all other people who are not a white man. And I'm sorry if you are a white man hearing this, my hope is that you are hearing this and thinking, yeah, this is all true, and I, as a white man, am trying to do my part to also be better. But if you are listening to this and finding yourself feeling frustrated, it just goes to show exactly, kind of in relation to compulsory sexuality, white men feel as if they are deserved more in life. And having been born, if you have been born a white man and are still a white, cisgendered, straight man, you still possess so many beliefs in you that make you believe that you have authority and that you have the right to a lot of things in life. I have found seldom in my life a white family man who does equal amount of chores throughout the household. I have also seldom found that the white straight man has less obligations in the household and the family structure that, say, the mother has. I've seen it a lot in, you know, friends of mine in the past and families. Women and the mothers are doing the most. And even if you've got a great dad out there, I have seen time and time again that you can be a great father, but you still don't contribute in a way that is beneficial to your family when it comes to stuff around the house, making appointments, buying clothes. Most of my friends who are women who are in relationships with men, they do everything. And they don't do everything because they want to do everything, or they have, you know, control issues, or they want to buy the perfect thing for their kids and they're just like, no, I'm going to do it. There's no reciprocation from the other end, I have seen quite often. And again, it falls back to men believing that they are deserved a lot in life, which can also lead to thinking that they also do not need to do some of the more domestic things in life that their wife or their feminine partners need to do. Off of that tangent and back into my next topic is the millennial generation and sex. So again, these are direct words from Shonda themselves. U.S. adults born in the 1990s and 1980s, both millennial and Gen Z, were more likely than Gen X born in the 1960s and 70s to report having no sexual partners after the age of 18. Another thing Sharonda says in relation to the media, which is very prevalent in all of our lives, whether we like it or not, despite what the media says, our generation, millennials, we are not lonely, porn-addicted careerists who are too selfish or too busy to get it on. According to top experts, Cosmos exclusive data and actual millennials, they say, we're the most experimental and enlightened and success and sexually fulfilled generation yet. And it goes back to my little quote at the very beginning of the episode. Asexuality is self-contained sexuality. You have the right and the freedom to express your own sexuality on your own and by yourself. And that was kind of condemned a lot back in the day. So it's funny to hear people, especially the older generations, critique us and think that we are lesser than them because of how we are choosing to live today. Another amazing little quote from Sharonda, because they were saying that there is this claim that to the alarmist claim of the sex recession, that the millennial sex recession is bullshit in 2019, collecting their own data and providing context that was gnarlingly absent from the commentary of young people and sexual activity, so those who actually were millennials. So they go on to say, this means the so-called sex recession is actually more of a sexual expansion, which I fully agree with, and I definitely can see that, because we are a generation where there are more people who are openly gay, who are openly trans, who are openly non-binary, who are openly asexual, who are openly intersex, all of these things. And the bullshit with like, oh, you just like labels and all of this stuff. These labels help us expand. They help us grow in our sexuality and who we are as people. Because of course these labels have existed for a while, some maybe not as long as others, but we were taught to repress those labels, because a lot of people, again, violence happens to people. You know, if you're a little boy in the 1970s, regardless of your race, and you come out as gay, well, not regardless of your race, because of course people of color are disproportionately abused far more than people who are white. But you know, 1970s little boy comes out being gay and he gets beaten to death, or he gets assaulted after school, or he gets assaulted by a man, like a professor, like one of his like teachers. I mean, I'm happy to be a millennial for a lot of reasons, but a big reason of just further acceptance with who we are and being able to confidently identify ourselves with labels that help validate who we are and how we feel. Those labels that we didn't have labels for in the past. I mean, Jesus, up until I was 25, even from my mother and father, you're going to meet the right man one day. Don't worry. You'll settle down and you'll find the right man. Again, everything is predetermined for me, and my parents, they don't put any pressure on me or my life, but their natural inclination, what they were also taught is, this is my cisgendered daughter who is a woman, and she will one day marry and find a cisgendered man. It's not anything that was felt harmful to me in the past. I knew that they were just saying that to say that, because that's how they were taught as well. And when we're taught that, the harm towards other people who are gay or trans or non-binary or people of color, especially those of color who are trans, non-binary, gay, asexual, it's the latter view that I was associated with my entire life. And a lot of people, I won't even get into right now the topic of men not being able to properly convey their emotions correctly. We can get into that another episode, but you know, it's the definition is right there. It's why we have so many male serial killers, people who terrorize and shoot up innocent children at schools are predominantly men, predominantly white men at that. But men were taught to be providers and all of these other things that were not relating towards the feminine in any way, shape, or form. Because if they related to the feminine, then they were considered weak. And weak so much to the point that we have neglected men's emotions. And a lot of men do not know how to properly communicate their feelings and emotions because of society and the patriarchy and what men were created, quote unquote, created to do. Again, we can get into that one later. Back to millennials. So get this, and I know a lot of millennials who are listening already know this and these figures and these numbers, but Excuse me, we're just here to talk about it. So, millennials make 4 times less than boomers did when they were our ages. We hear this all the time from generations above us, even some Gen Xers directly above us. You know, like millennials. Oh, this generation is so selfish. This generation is only focused on their careers. This generation doesn't care about the country or having families or investing in something like, oh, maybe a house. We are not given / we have no access to what the boomer generation had. And when boomers were around the same age as millennials, they held roughly 22% of the nation's wealth compared to the millennials at a measly 7%. As millennials, I mean, it's right there in the numbers. We do not have access to the things that my parents' generation, those who are, you know, declared as boomers, Generation Y, I believe, Y, X, W, A, B, C, W, X, Y, Z. So X. Nope. W. Generation W, Generation Boomer, whatever. We do not have what they had. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, why don't you start a family and buy a house and do all of these things that the patriarchy and the economy and cis heteronormativity want you to do? We don't have, even if there is a large portion of us out there who want to do that, and I believe that there's a large portion of us out there who are deciding against it just because our generation, for sure, we are about to experience and witness and be a part of some incredible, and I don't mean incredible in a great way, but some incredible climate change that is going to be highly disruptive and life-altering. And I know a lot of people do not want to have kids for that reason, bringing them into a world, into a country that is frankly dying. But instead of looking at the numbers and the facts and thinking about the future and the climate and thinking about the fact that we are given way less than the boomers were given, this doesn't cross their minds. We are judged. You know, it goes back to the, oh, I can't fathom being 30 and single and unmarried and don't have children and don't own my own home. Well, I bet you can fucking imagine it if you were my age today, because the luxuries that you got to experience are not the luxuries that I get to experience today. So, you know, the economy and the patriarchy, they want people to procreate. It goes back to compulsory sexuality. It goes back to all of these things. We were bred to bear children to continue to stimulate the economy. And when we have a generation who is experiencing having way less sex, a lot less teen pregnancies, a lot less marriage, a lot less of people deciding to not have a family, it directly affects the economy and the economy that was built in this world to be what it was, essentially, you know, way back when. And it was to procreate, it was to have a family, and it was to buy a home. Because a family of 3 or 4 or 5, the world and the economy can profit a lot more off of the family of 5 rather than the single person of 1. So, you know, when you have heard sometimes like, oh, you know, I don't really know if like my parents should have had kids, or, oh, I don't know if my like cousins twice cousin removed aunts, nephews, nieces, daughter should have had kids. Maybe about 8 times out of 10, they probably shouldn't have had kids, because a lot of people we're almost like forced and tricked into this life. We're tricked into thinking that we need to be active members of society and the world by doing these things that everybody else is doing. And of course, we're being tricked to do this because the economy is still number one. Who's making money in this country and in this world? Again, mostly white men. That's at the forefront. So people don't care about people who are asexual or on the spectrum or the gay couple who is choosing not to have kids. There is disdain towards us because we cannot help the economy in a way that the economy wants us to help them. I hope that made sense. I have had a glass of wine now. Again, another excerpt, insert paragraph from this book. You know, in regards to, you know, having this timeline of what we need to be doing in life, what is considered normal, what is considered being productive and a productive member to society. All of these things are intimately related and impact our economy, especially because they are so easy to capitalize on. Like I said, the family of five generates a lot more expenses than the solo person of one. So those invested in the capitalistic system work to convince us that these things are necessary parts of life and that the participation in them makes us mature and productive adults and members of society. Those people out there who didn't want to have kids or maybe shouldn't have had kids, their feelings were right to begin with. But because of the economy, the white man, I just sound like a broken record right now, and the media, what we are being fed, we are being taught, inherently taught generation after generation after generation after generation, that we need to do these things. And for the, I feel like, and this, you know, this group of millennials, you know, past Gen X and past the boomer stage, which was still a very prevalent stage to just go by the book, go by the white book and do what the whites do, and, you know, put into the economy what we need to be doing. Us having this sort of like recession of acting on these things and these systems that we have had in place and creating families and having that nuclear family that the economy wants us to have, we are disrupting the world and the economy. And again, Sharonda says in their book, in July 2020, Bloomberg published this: Americans aren't making babies, and that is bad for the economy. And Sharonda also says that there was 500,000 fewer births in 2021, so there were 500,000 fewer births in 2021 compared to even just 2020. So once the pandemic started, and then once the pandemic continued, there was a little bit of a pandemic baby boom, but then there was like a pandemic no baby boom. Because again, us millennials, we own 7% of the wealth of the world today. We fight to make our bills and our payments, because as the medium wage for what we are being paid kind of stays stagnant, the cost of living and the cost of having children, the cost of birthing a child goes up. So, of course, there are some millennials out there who are like, fuck this. Maybe even if they truly wanted to do that, they don't have the resources to do that. I mean, a common birth in the United States costs $20,000. And again, those who are marginalized, those who are people of color, those who have a hard time getting health insurance, they are displaced even further because of the color of their skin and who they are and the rights that we have given them in this country. So, of course, people who are marginalized and people of color, they are getting paid far less in this country. And yet, how are they expected to have a family and start a family of their own when it's just not affordable for most Americans, especially for those who of color who are getting paid less and maybe do not have similar accesses to those who are white and privileged when it comes to health insurance? I mean, this is all... it's not a big surprise when someone says to you, you know what, I don't want kids. There's a lot of reasoning behind there, but there is a lot of inability to even proceed with doing so, even if you wanted to. It is almost, it feels sometimes impossible to think about the future and to think about everything that you may have wanted to do, even if it's just land ownership or home ownership. Again, these prices that we are seeing today are insane. They are astronomically high. And we cannot afford to do the things that people generations above us were able to do. My parents, I think they owned their first house like when they were my age, at least by my age. There is no fucking way in hell I can own a house on my own right now. There's no fucking way in hell I can own a house probably in 5 years on my own, even if I do really well with my business. The median cost to just live today continues and continues and continues to go up. And millennials who are rejecting the norms of living, it's an indirect reaction to compulsory sexuality, going against what we are taught that we need, that we desire, and that we, what we should do in life. And touching back again to those who are marginalized and those who do want to have children, the government does not, they don't have us covered. They don't have those who are marginalized covered. They don't have those who are people of color covered. There is this definition of pronatalism. And Sharonda says that it's basically the sibling of compulsory sexuality. And it is the policy or practice, particularly on a government level, of encouraging the birth of children without concern for the quality of life and health of those children and the people who birth them. So a lot of you have probably been seeing recently these people protesting outside of abortion clinics. And a lot of these have the rhetoric of the conservative word programmed in their bodies, the word of compulsory sexuality, the word of having the nuclear family. And that overrides just the death of an embryo versus the life of a possible child. They don't care about that. They care about upholding their economy, upholding their government, and upholding this way of living that they deem to be right. And again, this directly affects those who are marginalized. Because those who are marginalized and maybe of color in a state where abortion is now banned, they are forced to have a child against their own will. And a lot of times, most people who want an abortion are women who already have children. That's a fact. Look it up. But you can't tell people, which is fucked up, but you can't tell people who are marginalized, people of color, to have a child and good luck raising it because we're not supporting you financially, we're not paying you adequate wages, we're not giving you the proper health insurance, and we're sure as shit not going to help you support your child. Oh, and we're also going to be depleted of formula roughly around the end of 2020. But good luck. So all of these mostly white supremacist conservative people who are petitioning for the rights of an embryo that is not even a living body that can extremely detriment the child in the future and the parents who are forced to have them. It's fucked up. And the government does not help, and they won't help. And the hypocrisy is at an all-time high. We are forcing you to have this child because this is what we believe in. And yet we're not going to help you out a bit once that child is earthbound. Patriarchy can suck a... Right, wrapping up. So, yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, the millennials, we are four times poorer. We have four times less than what the boomer generation had at our age. And yet we are still expected to uphold this idea and notion of having a nuclear family, and not only to proceed with that, but to be able to financially support like how boomers were able to support back in the day. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. And the fact that more people don't see that is very discouraging and disheartening and disturbing and all the other D words that I can think of. All right, friends, I've got one last thing to say to you. This is half of the book that I have basically regurgitated back to you. So we will be having more parts to this, you best believe. But this entire paragraph is what I'm going to end on. And after that, it's ended, because it's basically been says exactly what I have been saying and what the information and notes of nuggets and knowledge that I have gathered from Sharonda in their book. So the end of Sharonda's productivity chapter, you know, human beings being productive and reproducing and buying homes and doing all these things that we can't do anymore. This is their last paragraph of this chapter. We become only bodies for the nation state's use, and our bodies become instruments for amassing capital that marginalized workers will never be able to partake in as long as this system persists. Those who deprioritize or divest from sex, and often marriage and reproduction along with it, regardless of the reasons why, become a threat to the established systems that rely and thrive on the exploration and the extraction of labor from our bodies, including sexual and reproductive labor. In this system, those who exist outside of normative sexuality, particularly those socialized as women who do not perform adequate sexual or reproductive labor for male partners, are disordered problems to be fixed. Compulsory sexuality contributes to this constitution of our bodies as instruments for capital. And the rhetoric around the so-called sex recession and coronavirus baby bust reveals how our value becomes measured through our sexual and reproductive usefulness to the economy and the nation state. Thank you guys for being with me. Until next time. Again, I just want to shout out Sharonda J. Brown, the author of Compulsory Sexuality, A Black Asexual Lens on Our Sex-Obsessed Culture. Thank you so much to them. I am learning a lot, and I'm happy that I get to share it with you all. So thanks.